opinions voiced in Investing Simplified with Bo Caldwell are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine what may be appropriate for you, consult with your attorney, accountant, financial or tax advisor prior to investing. Investors cannot invest directly in indexes. The performance of any index is not indicative of the performance of any investment and does not take into account the effects of inflation and the fees and expenses associated with investing. Guests on Investing Simplified are not affiliated with CWM LLC. Investment advisory services offered through CWM LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor. Price Financial Group, wealth management.
We do Investing Simplified. Welcome into Investing Simplified. However you're joining us today, thank you for making us a part of your day. As a reminder, if you missed portions of the show or you'd like to listen to any replays of our past shows, you can find those wherever you get your podcasts. You can download them for free. Apple Podcasts, iTunes, iHeartRadio, and the like. You can also visit our website, www.pfgwm.com, where we have those archived for you. We have those up there so you can see the past few episodes. You can also visit investingsimplifiedradio.com, and we'd like you to go there and post your questions if you have a question that has been keeping you up at night, something you'd like us to answer here on the show as we cover them. We're going to have Taylor Cattell in here a little bit later, so make sure you're sending in those questions if you have a question about, you know, how to cover your assets. We're going to have, you know, hopefully have Kevin Stege on, the tax animal, on coming up soon. It is the, you know, the busiest time of the year for those tax preparers, so we may have to consign ourselves that we may not see him again until after April 15th. But speaking of April 15th, Matt, I know a lot of people, we've gotten a lot of questions where people are wondering where their 1099 is, wondering if I'm going to get a 1099 and, you know, if I should be paying attention for it. And we covered that a little bit earlier this year.
Yeah, at the end of the year we did, yeah.
And I talked about 1099s, but I think it's worth explaining to folks that the different ways and reasons you might get a 1099, what you should be looking out for on a 1099, and which form you don't have to worry about, which would be Form 5498. So a lot of people are getting those, the fair market value letter, in regards to their IRAs, right? So one of the things I wanted to talk about is the 1099 itself and what that means. And it's just a form from your brokerage or from your investment accounts or from your retirement accounts that those companies, wherever you custody your assets, so a custodian, as a reminder, is the place where your assets are housed, and they also insure your money against theft or fraud. They don't insure it against
volatility,
right? Or market downswings, but they insure it against theft or fraud. And one of their jobs is to aggregate all your different positions, right? They're a broker, so they go out, if you're going to buy, you go click on that button at TD Ameritrade and you click on buy that stock or sell that stock. They're the ones who take care of that transaction, but they are also the ones who measure the tax ramifications, right?
Right. And then at the end of the year, they add it all up on a nice, convenient form. It's called the 1099. And it has different variations to it, like one for dividends, one for interest,
yep,
and such. And so paying attention to those. But I think one of the things we talked about at the end of the year is that sometimes you may get one form at the beginning of, let's say, January, mid, late January sometimes. Mm-hmm. And then there'll be another one because it's potentially corrected that comes through a little bit later. So I think that it's wise to sort of wait and see. Don't wait till last minute to file taxes, of course, but you know, making sure, and if you're, you know, if you feel like you've had a lot of transactions in a given year, you can even call the custodian and say, hey, are we expecting these 1099s to be corrected? Is this the final version? If it is,
right,
great. If it's not, when will the final be available?
And, yeah, and most of the time it's available online,
yes,
right? So if you go online, it also gets sent out in paper. But a question that I've had a lot of folks ask is, where is my 1099 from my IRA? And when I respond, did you take money out of your IRA? And they say, no. So then, therefore, you don't get a 1099, because there's a difference, right? There's a difference
That's
between
true.
A taxable account, like you were just describing, yeah, that has interest or dividends,
yep,
and a tax-deferred account like an IRA.
Yeah, so IRAs, unless you took money out, you wouldn't get a 1099, because all the dividends and interest, that's just deferred. That's
right.
The whole idea.
And that applies to a Roth, too.
And it's same for Roth. So if you're waiting for those, they're possibly not coming, unless you're taking distributions out, and so you could proceed with your taxes. And I don't think you need those. I don't think it I'm pretty sure it doesn't indicate anything around if you've made contributions. That's not where that goes either.
No, that goes on your 5498, that form that I mentioned earlier, where there's a form that will come out.
Kevin would be proud of you knowing all these forms.
Right. That does come out in May, and that's where the custodian sends that to the IRS. Oftentimes, they will notify you of it. But it's to track your contributions, right? Because you designate contributions to your IRA on your taxes. It's not something like a 401k or 403b comes out just out of your paycheck, right? So the money comes out before you get paid.
Because you might have pre-tax contributions, post-tax contributions, or, you know, those are the main two types.
Right, right. So, and you're tracking those.
And then they're important. You know, people are like, well, usually people put money in the Roth or traditional. And so that's where, you know, the Roth one, a lot of times it's important to keep track of those bases too, because as we talked about on the show, there's accessibility to the basis for you when you make the contributions. You know, it's kind of a backup of an emergency fund if you ever need to tap into that.
Right. So that's how you track your basis or your contributions. But that doesn't have, so if you rule of thumb, long story short, if you have not taken distributions from your IRA, you shouldn't get a 1099. And it would be a 1099-R, like you mentioned. But you will get a 1099 if you have an investment account that's in a taxable account. Because even if you owned just mutual funds that are different, you didn't take any money out, and folks will say, well, why did I get a 1099? I didn't take any money out. Or how did I get a 1099 that says I made money even though my account was down for the last year, right?
Mutual funds will trick you that way sometimes.
Yeah. Exactly. So a lot of times if you have mutual funds inside your account and you didn't realize, they're distributing capital gains, which we talked about at the end of last year.
Yeah, they do. The managers, you know, they don't individually manage each one of the accounts. They manage the fund. And so if the fund itself is taking gains or losses, they'll pass those on to the shareholders of the mutual funds. And it'll maybe a gain or a loss. And so you might have a year where you're down, but you get a capital gains distribution out. That's
right.
True.
Right.
And it could also be flagged short-term, long-term, and all of the above. So the good news is it's all on one form. And as Bo mentioned, a lot of times it's accessible online. It's pretty much always accessible online now. And if you're filing taxes yourself, nowadays, you can simply let
the software pull
the data directly from the company, and, you know, computers typically don't make mistakes. And so as long as the form's accurate and everything, it'll come through. And it's still a good idea to glance over it to make sure it looks correct, right? Once it's happened. Mm-hmm. I know that's also available a lot of times for W-2s. Mm-hmm. More and more places are going electronic. One ad I'll do, since you didn't mention it yet, is banks also send out 1099s for interest.
Right.
But one thing to keep in mind is if the interest was less than $10, they won't ship out a 1099. But technically, it's still reportable income, so you should report it.
Right.
So that's one that I know people will sometimes call the bank, like, hey, where's my 1099? Well, you only made
$4
this year.
On your $100,000 account.
Yeah.
That, and you know, that can be a big trip up. The big key you mentioned there, though, is reportable income. And a lot of times people miss out on reportable income, particularly when they have income, like you were saying, Matt, with, you know, their interest that they didn't know about, or 1099 distributions that they didn't know about and they're not paying attention, and they have to go back and refile later. So it's really important to make sure that you know how much income you had and make sure that you're reporting it right, because it can be a real problem when you have to refile your taxes. You got to pay for them and do all that stuff. So we're going to take a quick break here because Taylor just walked into the studio. We're super excited to have her back on the show. So we're going to take a break and we'll be back with Cover Your Assets.
Leaving an employer can be stressful and overwhelming, but once the dust settles and you're at a new job or perhaps retired, it is important to consider your options for that retirement plan left behind. If this situation applies and you would like to hear more about options available for 401k, 403b, or other retirement account rollovers, please give our office a call at 503-253-3000 to schedule a complimentary consultation with someone on the team to go over your specific and individual situation. We will take the time to get to know you, your goals, and let you know what the best course of action is for you and your family.
We do Investing Simplified.
You're listening to Investing Simplified. Now, back to Bo Caldwell.
Welcome back to Investing Simplified. However you're joining us, thanks for making us a part of your day. As promised, back in studio finally with Cover Your Assets. Here is Taylor Cattell joining Matt and I here in studio. Hello, Taylor. It's so wonderful to see you. I know people have been, you know, I've gotten a couple of listener complaints that it's just the three
just
of us.
Us. Yeah. Just us. And we got some emails asking questions of you.
Yeah, we did get, we do oftentimes, you know, get questions, and they're not usually particularly geared towards me, surprisingly enough. People want to hear your answers or Kevin's answers.
They'll ask in the emails, like, could you ask Taylor this? Like, well, I could probably answer, but I guess I'll see if Taylor's got.
Well, it's nice to be loved. Nice to get questions.
Right. Well, so one I had, and I know I sent this over to you and Kevin, we were talking a little bit about it, off air, I guess. But, you know, I think it's good to talk about is we've had some issues come up where we've had multiple people come and talk about, you know, having beneficiaries not be properly named on their retirement accounts. And I know we've talked a bunch about that's a big thing. Number one, you should review all the time, you know, your beneficiary designations. But what actually happens if someone has a retirement account, an IRA or a 401k or a profit sharing account that doesn't have a named beneficiary and they were to pass away?
That's a great question. So the first thing to always remember is that beneficiary designations trump your estate plan. That is one of the most common clarifications that a lot of people have misinformation that they think once they do an estate plan, it just takes away their beneficiary designations and everything is coordinated. It's the opposite. If you have an estate plan, that's only going to govern things that don't pass by operation of law. So I know we've talked about this before, but it's such a common misunderstanding. I just want to hammer home the point that beneficiary designations trump your estate plan. Joint ownership trumps your estate plan. If you have anything that's kind of by operation of law or by contract, that trumps your estate plan. So whenever we're looking at, well, what happens, we always have to look at it holistically and say, well, is there a joint owner on this account? Is there a beneficiary on this account? When I say beneficiary, I mean the broader scope. It could be a pay on death designation. It could be a transfer on death designation. It could say beneficiary. There's different language depending on the financial institution. It all means the same thing. You have a contract that upon your death, this money goes to this person. That's that beneficiary designation that in any context is very, very powerful. Even if you got divorced and the divorce judgment doesn't say I revoke that beneficiary designation and you forget to change it, that contract provision controls. So very, very important. I'm not a family law attorney. I don't want to be. But if there is having a properly drafted dissolution agreement, but even better, actually changing your beneficiary designation appropriately is absolutely critical. So it's really, really powerful, really important stuff and gets messed up all the time. So then we come to, well, what actually happens? And what happens legally can be very different from what happens in the real world.
Right.
Practically. Right. So what I can talk about is what's supposed to happen.
Sure.
But the reality is that other things happen all the time. And sometimes that's great. Right. Sometimes what the legal process that it would take and the tax consequences of that legal process are not nearly as beneficial as the financial institution seeing where the money is going to go and helping you get to where it kind of should have been anyway. But that's not legally how they're supposed to do it. And so I have myself seen situations where a financial institution, we were making the argument for who it needed to get to, and the financial institution ultimately did distribute the funds there. And when my client called me and told me that, I went, really? I don't know how they did that. That doesn't make any legal sense to me.
It shouldn't have happened.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So do we go and poke around and poke the bear and say, well, you probably shouldn't have done that, and go alert compliance to that? You know, I have a duty to tell my clients you know that you have this vulnerability. Mm-hmm. Know that from a tax standpoint, you really need to make sure your accountant understands how this went. Don't go spend all the money in case you're going to have some tax consequences from this. But at least now you're in tax land and you're in control of the money instead of it being held up by this financial institution, you know, in this indefinite never, never land without a clear owner. or a deceased owner, but not even in the estate. It just gets really complicated. So know that there are sometimes some financial institutions that are more willing to work with you than others on how do we get the result that probably should have been done. But when your beneficiary designation is not updated or it's not accurate or it's missing altogether and there isn't one, mm-hmm. then there are legal processes, depending on what your situation is, that can resolve that. But you typically don't have as good of tax consequences. So if you have the big picture legal default, I would say, is that if there is no beneficiary named, that is an asset of the estate.
Okay.
So if somebody had a revocable trust, you still have to go through probate.
Wow.
Legally speaking, right. Sure. Because you have to have somebody who has the authority to claim that asset. It's not an asset of the trust because it has to go through probate to get to the trust.
The trust, yeah.
So you have to open, again, this is the legal side. You have to open a probate estate. What if the estate, as I've seen, has already closed?
Yeah.
Yep.
And you found it 2 years later. Maybe it's been 7 years since the person died, right? And you've already gone through everything. And then all of a sudden you get some 1099 out of somewhere or something. Right. And you're like, wait, whoa, where did this? I don't even have this asset. And all of a sudden you find out it's in deceased person's name. There's a legal process for reopening the probate.
Okay.
So again, the right legal process would be to reopen the estate, reappoint the personal representative, take custody of those assets, and then get a court order to distribute those assets. It's faster than a traditional, you know, a standard probate because you've already notified creditors. All those are barred. But you're still talking about, you know, attorney's fees and petition, you know, filing fees and a process there. So it's not something that you want to do, but it is an option that's available. It's also possible that you could, again, as sort of the extra legal process, you could say, here are all the documents from when I was a personal representative. And again, they shouldn't give you those assets, but it might be enough to bypass the right legal process. So I'm not advising that.
Right.
I'm not putting that on advising anybody, but I do see how sometimes it's up to the institution to release the funds.
Right.
And the other than taxing authorities, which we'll talk about next, the other people with claims out there are going to be the people whose economic interests are affected.
Right.
And so if you're ultimately getting it to the people who would get it anyway through the probate process or everybody's in agreement on how this is all supposed to work, you have less potential liability out there.
Right.
That makes sense.
So in that situation, you know, hypothetically, let's say I passed away. I didn't put a beneficiary on my old profit sharing, you know, account that I had. It's been sitting there for 7 years because I died 7 years ago, and now the estate's all been closed. So the steps would hypothetically be: you got to go open a new probate. You got to go get an attorney. Go open a probate case. I'm hearing cha-ching, cha-ching, cha-ching as I'm saying these things, right?
Yeah.
I just don't know how to say it more than we've said it. Make sure your beneficiaries line up.
An ounce of prevention, right? An ounce of prevention is absolutely a pound of cure, worth a pound of cure. And I would say it's not in the, it's more than hundreds, less than 10,000s, right? So we're probably talking a couple $1,000 is the cost versus the time now to call your advisor or to do your due diligence with whatever customer service line. It may be painful. I'm right with you. The phone trees, that's the nice thing about having a financial advisor is you can get that information sooner and more quickly. You should be able to just pick up the phone and say, hey, do I have a beneficiary on that account?
Yeah, who is it?
Is that updated? Who is it? How do I change it? And they should be able to tee that up for you. But for clients who are hesitant, that's usually because they're doing the self-investing thing and they have to go on a 1-800 number and whatever else. It's still worth your time.
Yeah.
It is still worth doing it, however it takes.
And the amount of the asset that you're sort of uncovered doesn't really matter, right? I mean, it all has to pretty much reflow through the estate. So if you're talking about like a $10,000 account you just found, you might have some additional costs regardless of the amount you found.
Correct. And that can be a real doozy sometimes because they may not tell you how much it is because you don't have authority.
Oh, that's true. I mean, if you find like a $1 million account and you have to reopen, it's like, okay, well, it's a little bit better.
But if you get notice of a life insurance policy, and this is when I was a personal representative, mm-hmm. I had closed the estate, and it was 3 years later I got notice of a life insurance policy that hadn't been paid, and I sent out a letter saying, basically, I'm not lifting a finger until you tell me how much it is. Here's all my authority. Here's everything else that I had, but the estate is closed and I'm not going to reopen it until you tell me how much it's worth. And a lot of times they will not even tell you that, but I just wanted, again, to do that due diligence piece. It came back at less than $500.
Oh, okay.
The filing fee alone is going to be like $550. Yeah. So no.
Right, right.
You go ahead and put that into unclaimed property.
So I was going to say, so that is that what happens? It then goes to unclaimed property. It gets escheated to the state.
Generally speaking, if they can't find, and if their paperwork doesn't automatically distribute it to any other heirs. So whenever you do a life insurance policy or whenever you sign up for a retirement account, there's usually that boilerplate that really hard to read. Nobody reads it. Mm-hmm. I don't read it. I probably should, but there will be some default provisions in there that say what they have to do and what they don't have to do and who would take it. And that's what can change. So sometimes those contracts will say that if there is no named beneficiary, it goes to your nearest kin, right? Well, how are they going to define that? If that could be defined differently in different states, depending on our adopted kids counted, and what if they're, you know, there's just some nuances there. But generally speaking, it's going to fall the same way, right? Spouse and kids. So it comes back to, well, what if you're single?
Right.
Well, then is it your parents? What if your parents have died? Or how much work is this company going to go to find your heirs? And all of that, then, you know, they usually say at some point it goes to the estate so that somebody else has to come to claim it. And again, if nobody does, then it's on them to go through whatever process they have to close unclaimed accounts. Side note, Oregon and Washington, I just saw an article about this, are really attempting to return the unclaimed property. I don't know if you've heard this, but
I haven't.
Oh, really?
Well, you can look it up online and you can actually put in your name and you can see any unclaimed property items out there.
I've done several of those forms as a notary. So you just go online and you plug in your name and it'll give you a form and you fill it out and you got to get it notarized and then you submit it. Usually they're pretty small claims, but you know, sometimes you get a bigger one. It doesn't give you the exact, it'll say like less than $100, or it'll say, you know, less than $500. It'll give you an estimation, and then you just have to get in front of a notary with a form to claim it. Yeah.
And now I guess Oregon is actually trying to reach out to people based on their contact information with their income tax filings, which is why Washington is having a hard time because they don't have their own separate income tax, so they don't have updated information. And I guess the driver's licenses is not turning out to be accurate. So it was just interesting. I think the states are trying to beef up not holding on to this much property. But that's just another thing on the checklist if you're administering estate, is to do that search while the estate is still open or while you're still an acting fiduciary or trustee or personal representative, to try to avoid having those things come back and haunt you later. But prevention, number one.
Right.
And I like what you added about the prior spouses. I think that comes up way more than you think. You know, if you have gone through a separation or divorce and then you have an old spouse on there that shouldn't be on there, you know, as you said, by law, it'll go to that person unless otherwise, you know, it's removed. And, you know, if you work with a financial institution, they'll go with what's on paper, you know?
Exactly.
It basically...
That's what's safe.
Yeah. Yeah.
The financial institution is whatever's on paper. So do it. Do what's on paper with what you want and you'll be in a much better place.
That doesn't always mean, because we've run into clients before that prefer to have their exes on there for some reason or another. So if that's the agreement you have, that's great. You know, sometimes there may be little kids involved or younger children. And so they know they just, you know, aren't married, but that doesn't mean they don't, you know, want to take care of each other. And so then they can maybe have the ex-spouse on there still, but it's just important to check. Which actually was another question that came up this week was, what happens if somebody names minor children on as a beneficiary? And we can talk about this now or after the break if you
I think it's probably a good time to take a quick break and then we talk about minor children and whether or not to leave, you know, minor children, because I think it's important to think not just about your retirement accounts but about, like you mentioned, life
everything
insurance
else.
Right. So that's a big thing that a lot of times if you're a single parent or a divorced parent and you don't want to name your ex-spouse.
So there's lots of reasons not to, unless you are obligated by that judgment,
right,
which is the most common. But
Right. I guess probably a discussion for another day, repercussions of, divorce attorney stuff. But, we'll be right back. We're going to take a little break here and we'll be right back. Talk some more beneficiary, super exciting,
all the things that could go wrong.
Mind blowing stuff. But if you have a question about your investments, you want to have somebody help review those beneficiary designations, you can give our office a call, 503-253-3000. If you haven't updated your estate plan, if you haven't reviewed where things should be left and what's the best route, you can give Taylor's office a call.
Yep. 503-878-8948.
Perfect. And you can also send us an email, askbo@pfgwm.com or taylor@kglawgroup.com. Right? Did I get that
right? You got it.
Woohoo! Yeah, it's been the first
look
time
at you.
I know.
Good job, Bo.
Next time you'll get my phone number.
Right? Yeah. I just write them down. I used to do that with Kevin all the time, and I'd be like, what's your phone number again? Ugh, the worst. All right. We'll be right back with more Investing Simplified.
When planning for income and retirement, there's a lot to consider between managing the budget that fits the family, trying to figure out from where to draw your income, or balancing the tax ramifications of withdrawals. Moving into retirement can be overwhelming. At Price Financial Group, we help clients work to create a sustainable retirement roadmap, addressing these concerns and more, and helping folks feel confident in their future retirement income, right when they need it most. If you'd like a financial plan tailored just for you, please don't hesitate and call our office today at 503-253-3000 or text REVIEW to 484848 to set up your complimentary consultation. Price Financial Group offers investment advisory services through CWM LLC, an SEC registered investment advisory firm.
We do Investing Simplified.
You're listening to Investing Simplified. Now, back to Bo Caldwell.
And welcome back to Investing Simplified. If you're just now tuning in, we've been covering our assets with Taylor Cattell back in studio with Matt Sudol and myself, Bo Caldwell, CEO of Price Financial Group. If you have a question that's been keeping you up at night, something that Taylor can answer, as we talked about a little bit earlier in the show, I know most people want to hear her talk rather than us, or something for Kevin, give us a shout at AskBo, AskBo@pfgwm.com. So, we were talking, before the break about beneficiaries and what to do if you don't have a beneficiary named. Make sure you name one.
Yeah.
But what if in the situation where you're thinking, okay, I want to name my kids, my minor children, as beneficiary because maybe I'm divorced or a widower,
or
been widowed.
Or it's a contingent.
Even naming the kids as a contingent. That's huge. That's a really good point because maybe my wife is my primary beneficiary, right. And now I've named my kids as contingent, and I know that there can be pitfalls with that, right? So, what, generally speaking, right? How do people navigate that? How do you decide where to name and who to name?
It's really a frustrating piece because I want to shout from the rooftops and just educate every customer service representative out there about testamentary trust. What are testamentary trusts? Why do they exist? And when and how do they work? Testamentary trusts are trusts that are established after somebody dies. So a testamentary trust can be established after somebody dies through a will. The will can say, upon my death, I establish a trust for my kids. That's a testamentary trust. A testamentary trust can also be established within a revocable trust. So your revocable trust says, this is my money, it's still my money, but upon my death, I give everything to my spouse, or if he or she predeceases me, I give it to my kids in trust. That trust has different terms than the revocable living trust because we, as a revocable living trust, want to control it, want to pull it out. But as an irrevocable testamentary trust, it's really important that that's a distinguished, separate piece. So the ideal legal beneficiary designation would be to the testamentary trust directly. That would allow depending on how the terms of the trust are drafted, but hopefully that would allow the testamentary trust to be treated as a pass-through entity to the kids.
To the kids, okay.
But that's where it gets complex. So the difference for me, when I just boil it down into a little bit more plain English, is this asset going to be subject to income tax.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's a Roth retirement account, okay, right? If it's cash and life insurance proceeds,
okay.
If it's an investment account that you have in an individually or a joint investment account where you want to put a pay on death or a transfer on death, if it goes through your estate plan, so that's your revocable trust, or through the probate process through your will, mm-hmm. and your trust or your will establish this trust for your kids, then it's going to get to the right end result. And it's not subject to income tax, so there's not going to be some other funky disruption there.
Oh, I see. Okay.
A negative consequence. It's cash. And it's just making sure the same as any other bank account or anything else. If it's already, you've already paid the income tax, or it's not subject to income tax, then it's going to flow through and follow as part of your estate. The difference, and maybe this is a little bit too nuanced, but the difference between having, let's say, a life insurance policy, let's just say you have a $500,000 life insurance policy,
mm-hmm.
and that pays out to your estate, okay. instead of to the trust for your kids. The key difference there is that if you are subject to claims, creditor claims in the estate process, that money is now available to pay them.
Oh, I see. Ooh. Versus okay? if it went to the...
If it bypasses your estate, it's not technically an estate asset. Yes. And it's more protected.
That makes sense. Okay.
Now, some people may say, but I want that money to pay other debts like estate tax liability, right? It could be that life insurance isn't intentionally there
yeah.
to take care of creditors. I want to pay off the mortgage on my house so that my kids can live there, you know, and the guardian can move in and whatever scheme makes sense.
Sure.
So that can be an intentional piece, or it could be a whoops. And so you don't want it to be a whoops. You want to choose... This is what the beneficiary, this is where we want it to go. But the whole equation shifts when it's income tax deferred. So when you have a 401k, when you have a traditional retirement account, when you have a SEP IRA, when you have something else where you have deferred income tax,
mm-hmm.
that's where it gets really tough. Because if you name an estate, or if you don't have a beneficiary, going back to the earlier conversation, and it goes right. to your estate, tax-wise, it should be taxed at the estate level. Okay?
Okay.
So that means that it typically, the strict rule would be that it has to be paid out within 5 years.
Yeah.
But the difference between right now and 5 years is usually so minor, because it's just dragging out the probate process. You usually just take the tax hit, cash it out, and pay it that year. And then at least you have net value to pass on.
Mm-hmm.
I know working with a qualified CPA, under some circumstances, you can try to distribute that out so that the income that is taxed at the individual level instead of at the estate level.
Oh, I see.
But that's still, we're talking pretty complicated stuff already, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
We're talking mm-hmm. pretty like in the weeds, where you definitely need an attorney involved, and you definitely need a CPA involved.
Yeah.
And you want to make sure that those two are talking to each other and generally saying the same thing, or an agreement about the process and the way to get there. But all of that, you're also banking on nothing else going awry. Like maybe you can't close the estate and distribute the assets because there are other debts out there. Maybe this is all happening in November and the end of the year is going to be rolling around and you're going to have to pay taxes based on a calendar year.
Right.
Right. So there are things outside of your control where you don't want to just assume that we're going to be able to pass out any of this to the beneficiaries. You want to assume the worst, plan for the worst, and address that.
Sure.
If you're in that planning process. And the best way to do that is to make sure your beneficiaries match your intention.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So when I'm talking about when you would want it to be a testamentary trust, that adds this whole layer of complication, right? Because you're naming the trustee of the trust established for the benefit of this child under my will dated blah, 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 right? That's not one of the boxes that they give you
right.
to check on the form. And so a lot of people, I would venture to say the vast majority of people, like maybe 90% of people probably don't, mm-hmm. even when they do their plans with me and I've hammered this home, get so frustrated and so confused. And then the question, you know, customer service person is telling them, well, that's not how you need
yeah.
an EIN to name the,
yeah.
to name the, well, there is no EIN because there's no tax ID number because
until
the trust
set up, yeah.
doesn't exist.
Yeah.
But it will. It will have one when that paperwork needs to be filled out to distribute it out. It will,
mm-hmm.
but that's not comfortable for,
right. for the customer service person.
Exactly.
On the phone. Yeah.
Well, and you've come across that, you know, similarly where you deal with, you know, insurance companies, particular, yep. are tough, right? Or even financial services providers that don't understand,
yeah.
when they say, because it's not a box, like you said, that the wording. That, you know, that we've used in that case when it's a testamentary trust established U/W, right? Because that has to fit.
Right.
Has to fit in the amount of characters they have. But then it gets, you know, what's called NIGOT or not in good order, right? They send it back and say, well, you can't do this, but, you know.
Yeah, but you can. Taylor said we could.
Taylor said I could, therefore.
So if somebody then, if I'm thinking about this right, so if the will sets up the testamentary trust, would you just then maybe leave it blank is better than minor children, because then it'll go to the estate and then the estate will push it off to the testamentary trust?
So you have to weigh a couple of options when it's a tax deferred account. Mm-hmm. When it's, and it also depends on the value of that account. So let's say you have a SEP IRA that you've just kept where it is, but it's only $10,000 and it is what it is, right? If that's not going to make or break between the tax liability, it may not be worth it. It may be better just to have it go to your estate. Just because of the headache and the hassle. But if you have a $500,000, you know, asset, then that's a different equation, because the tax liability is higher, but also the risk of your kids having that money potentially outright is higher. So here's I said in the last segment, your beneficiary designations trump your estate plan.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So the only thing not to do, absolutely not to do, is actually name your kids.
Okay.
Okay. Because then it's not going through your estate to their trust.
Right.
It's going to them individually, and it's let me put a little asterisk here. I'm talking about minor kids.
Right.
Okay.
Right,
I'm talking about kids who
under
are
18.
Too young to manage their own,
right.
or disabled kids, mm-hmm. or disabled anybody's, or anyone who you do not want to receive that asset at age 18. So even if it's a 19-year-old or a 25-year-old, they're not a minor child, but you don't, maybe they have an alcohol problem or a drug abuse issue,
right,
or they're receiving public benefits, or you just don't want them to have that money. You don't think they're responsible and you'd rather mm-hmm. take a tax hit or have somebody else manage it, depending again on what it is. Now you're in a little bit more of a conundrum.
Sure.
But let's assume that you're saying, I don't want this child to have it outright. I want it to be controlled by that trust. If you name the child outright, it is going to that child.
Right.
So then you're now in a conservatorship situation where every dollar that goes in, every dollar that goes out is all subject to the court approval with accountings and fees and filing stuff. And it's expensive and it's stressful. And it's also ties up the money mm-hmm. in a way that is not actually available for the use of the child.
Yeah.
And that's the court's public policy of parents or other guardians who often end up being conservators think that that's like free money. And there's been so much abuse of it mm-hmm. that they're very, very tight. And basically, unless you can prove that the kids really need that money, they have Social Security, they have other things. So no, you can't use it for summer camp. Mm-hmm. No, you can't use it for braces. Those aren't necessarily valid expenses. That is for the child. Don't waste their money. That's theirs at age 18, which is really contrary to just about everything I hear from my clients. I want the guardian to be able to have money. I want the guardian to be able to put them in private school. I want the, you know, I'm picking these people for a reason.
Right.
And I want them to have the flexibility to use my money for my kids. So it's that's my only kind of big don't do, is don't name the minor child directly. Either have it go through your estate so that maybe it takes a tax hit, but better that, if that's your choice, better that than having it, you know, subject to the court supervision. Or you could try to get it directly to that testamentary trust, which is perfect, because then you can try to have it taxable as if it's naming the child, right? And have it be what's called a see-through trust. But that gets into the boilerplate and why boilerplate matters.
Right.
So do work, if you do this stuff, do work with an attorney who actually does estate planning. Because it's not just about saying, I have a trust for my kids.
Right.
You can go through all that hassle, and if your boilerplate isn't there to allow this type of tax defer or pass through tax election, and then you don't have a good CPA who can actually do that, then you haven't accomplished that goal.
Right. Well, yeah, I think that's a big point to just hammer home. And I know it always seems like we're, you know, driving people to, you know, we're not trying to scare anybody, but in terms of, hey, boilerplate language, you know, the terminology that I've heard used, ink is cheap, right?
Mm-hmm.
Litigation, court costs are expensive.
Yeah.
Right. So like if you have to spend a little extra time to put a little couple extra drops of ink, yeah, maybe you got to go see an attorney rather than just using mm-hmm. Rocket Lawyer or LegalZoom, right?
Mm-hmm.
Go see someone who not just, and what I heard you say, which really speaks to me, in, you know, with my experience, and for those who don't know, full disclosure, Taylor is my estate attorney, right? So like, I'm eating where I'm recommending, yeah. Right? For lack of a better, that's a gross phrase, but lack of a better phrase, the idea that you work with an attorney who is not just, mm-hmm. doesn't just do estate planning, but specifically has worked with, if in the case where you have special children with special needs or adult children with special needs, or you're leaving it to someone with that they do, this is what they have worked with, right? You have an experience with special needs and special needs trusts,
right?
And how the different ins and outs, that you work with an attorney who knows
mm-hmm.
about, because, you know, we've talked about it before, right? There, a lot of people go through law school and pass the bar exam. Doesn't mean that they have that experience and have really worked on making sure that your needs and your wishes are followed, right? Because you're not there anymore. You can't be there looking out for it. You want to make sure that your kids or your special needs beneficiaries get the best.
You know, and that's one of the hardest things about estate planning is that you can't fix it once you realize it's something's wrong.
Sure.
Right. That's when you realize that something could have been done better.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm young and I care about my career. And so when some of my clients say, gosh, it seems like you're making this kind of complicated, you know, I think you might be like overthinking it. I'm going, your kids aren't going to say that.
Right.
You know, that's not what I'm imagining them sitting across the table from me and asking why I didn't talk to you about this.
Yeah.
And that's in the future. Where I have to go from as a practitioner. But if you haven't done the probate or trust administration side of it and you haven't had those difficult conversations about why the attorney didn't put this in the boilerplate and now you can't make this tax election, and you're going to have to pay what? You know, those are the tough things. And if you are just taking a form and it's really not that different, in my opinion, from Rocket Lawyer, if you have a lawyer who has a law degree but doesn't actually practice in these areas. So,
yeah, and it's someone or, you know, it just gets generated and then, you know, probably speak with that particular person. And to them, you're just, you know, I mean, they got your name and everything and they created, but they don't really get the time to really get to know what exactly you're trying to do. And then, as you said, a lot of them will maybe on the front end of the, call it interaction, where they just set up the estate plan, but they don't ever administer it. So they don't really know how it unwinds in the future, where you've been on both sides. So you see it. And so you're like, well, I've been on the other side. And if we don't do what I, you know, pre-planned, this is the outcome that we have to deal with. And I've got prior experiences. I think that speaks volumes.
Yeah. And it doesn't have to be me. Right. I mean, I'm happy but there's a lot of really good practitioners in the Portland, Vancouver areas that and all over who do this. But I think it's as easy for attorneys to just put wills as a practice area, even though they primarily do criminal defense or they primarily do DUIs or whatever it is. It's easy for that to throw them up there and then they just have a will or family law. And then they don't actually have the experience to support that.
That's true. And I've heard you say this too before, Taylor, where I'll ask you a question like, well, that gets to this type of law and that's not my expertise. So I'll tell you what I think, but I'm going to stick with what I know. And this is what I deal with. And so you've said that to me before.
Yep.
And then I'll just go and, you know,
I'll find somebody who can answer that.
Yes, exactly.
Right, yeah.
It's not me.
Yeah. Or you just put the little asterisk in there and say, hey, Matt, this is what I think, but you know, I'm not an expert in this and that's okay. You know, that's kind of like where it goes when it comes to financial advice. We know what we do know. There's areas where we have to look things up or, you know, reach out to departments.
I don't look things up.
Yeah, you do. You just walk over to my office and say, hey, Matt, what was this? You know, or email one of our team members.
I plead the fifth. I can neither confirm nor deny that. Yeah. But I mean, that goes back to when you're working with, you know, to be working with a team. Mm-hmm. You know, so if you're working with a financial advisor, if you're working with a state attorney, which you should be, I would say, working with both of those, but you want to make sure that they coordinate with your other practitioners. And it doesn't have to be, you know, somebody that, you know, is on a radio show together. If you work with me, doesn't mean you have to work with Taylor or Kevin. Yeah. Work with Taylor doesn't mean you have to work with me and Kevin, right? But you want to work with a practitioner, whether mm-hmm. that's in the law or in the accounting field or in the financial services, that is willing and able to work with your other professionals, right?
Exactly.
Because you want to make sure everything's coordinated. That's another big thing.
Exactly right. Mm.
That I heard in there. So I know you got to get out of here. So we're gonna take a break there. But before we do, tell everybody again, because I did not write down your phone number. So how do people get a hold of you if they have questions about estate planning? They want to make sure that they're not just boilerplating it up. How do they get a hold of you?
Yep. Taylor Cattell with KG Law Group. And you can call us at 503-878-8948 or email me at Taylor, that's T-A-Y-L-O-R, at kglawgroup.com.
Perfect. And if you have a question for Matt or myself, or you'd like to sit down, have a review of your beneficiary situation, we will be happy to dial that 800 number with you and make sure we, you know, get you through those hoops with customer service. Give us a call, 503-253-3000, or visit us on the web at pfgwm.com. We're going to be back with a little more Investing Simplified right after these fine words.
Legal matters are never easy, but they are especially difficult when they involve the most important people and aspects of your life. This is Taylor Cattell, founding partner of KG Law Group. It's important to have an attorney who cares about your unique circumstances and knows how to get the outcome that is best for you. At KG Law Group, we specialize in estate planning and family law, including wills, trusts, powers of attorney, guardianship, and divorce. At KG Law Group, we provide both expertise and compassion as we guide you through the complex legal landscape. We balance knowledge of the law with exemplary client service. Whether you're reacting to a crisis or planning for the future, we are here to help. If you need legal advice, give us a call today and schedule a consultation at 503-878-8948. That's 878-8948. Or visit us online at kglawgroup.com. That's kglawgroup.com, serving Oregon and Southwest Washington. KG Law Group, your family, your legacy.
You're listening to Investing Simplified. Now, back to Bo Caldwell.
Welcome back to Investing Simplified. If you're just now joining us, you missed great segments, great conversations with Taylor Cattell of KG Law Group. But as a reminder, you can replay the show.
Have no fear. It's available online.
Right? It is available online via podcast or on our website at pfgwm.com. Man, I it's not as exciting, but it has been something that people have sent in questions about a lot. I wanted to ask, you know, people have asked about 1099s. I wanted to go back to it a little bit. We talked about income and income that you might have missed. But one thing that people don't consider with the 1099 situation is IRA rollovers, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
so
that's true.
People don't think about when you've done a rollover either from a 401k or a 403b, or you do a rollover IRA to IRA, the generation of a 1099 and when it will generate and when it won't and what to do if it does.
Definitely don't panic. If you did the rollover correctly, the form should have, you know, both boxes. There's a couple boxes checked off showing that it's a distribution, but also a qualified rollover. And then you do have to put in some of that information if you're, you know, filing your taxes like with a software or your accountant would, but it nets to nothing really.
Right.
It still has to be recorded.
Right. Well, interestingly enough, sometimes this happens, and we've had this happen to a couple of clients actually, right?
Yep.
Where you request the rollover, you have it go direct, you're trying to do a direct rollover or a direct transfer, right? So what happens if you, so first let's start there with rollover versus transfer, right? So a rollover is when you're moving money from one kind of plan to another kind of plan, right?
Right.
Whether it's an IRA to an IRA, or you're doing an IRA or a 401k to an IRA, or vice versa. And a rollover occurs when the money doesn't transfer electronically. There's a check. Mm-hmm. There's a check issued, right?
And so, you might be handling that check.
Right. So the check, that's a step in the next. That's the next step, right? If that check is made directly, so let's say we use TD Ameritrade. So let's say you got your rollover from your 401k direct to TD Ameritrade, meaning the check will be made out to TD Ameritrade for the benefit of you, right? So we say for the benefit of Matt Sudol, account number this. That is a direct transfer, right? A direct rollover, rather. So that's not a taxable event, right? Because the money never hit you. You never got to handle the check. You never took custody of it. You never got it in your hands. But you may, depending on the plan, get a 1099-R that says you distributed it. If they process it correctly, like you said, on the 1099, it should say this much money was taken out. It was a qualified rollover, because there is that section on there that
there's
says what type
there,
of, right? It has letters on there, whether what kind of distribution it was, because it is a distribution from that plan.
Yes.
So if it's a normal distribution, if it's an early distribution, any of those things, but it is coded properly. Now they match that up with, here's the key, is when it gets deposited at the new location, whether that's at TD Ameritrade or in your new plan or wherever that is, there is coding for that deposit as well. Yeah. And that's where the IRS matches those up.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens if you have a processing error or something goes wrong, you have the insurance company distributed the check and didn't, and issued a 1099, did not say this was a direct rollover. So we had this happen where a client got a 1099 that said, hey, you took a $200,000 distribution, and he had a little bit of a panic moment.
Yeah.
Because he didn't withhold taxes. He doesn't want to pay taxes on $200,000, especially since he's not taking the money out. Right. So luckily for him, he talked to his CPA and they said, okay, this wasn't supposed to be done like that, but this is how you fix it. But if you're preparing your own taxes, you may have to code it as what's called an indirect rollover, right? And so as long as you got that money deposited into your new retirement plan within 60 days,
yeah,
it's not a taxable event.
Yeah, and you're allowed to do one of those per year.
Right.
Versus the direct transfer trustee to trustee can be unlimited in a mm-hmm. given year. So right. That's important to note. So again, don't panic if it happened. It could be that the financial institution made a mistake or, you know, something in transition happened. But just be aware of what could be on your 1099, which is what we've been talking about. So
yeah, so different. It could say on there, as long as you deposited that into another qualified plan, whether that's an IRA, a SEP IRA, a simple IRA, a 401k, 403b, anything that is a tax-deferred plan, as long as you deposited into that within 60 days
is key.
Then you're not it's not a distribution to you.
Right, and the IRS does that because, you know, hypothetically, you could distribute the money, go and buy something and then sell it and put it money back. So you could be floating the money. So they don't want you to do that very much other than maybe, you know, we could maybe get away with it for once a year.
Right.
But at the same time, that 60-day time is, you know, that's not very long. I mean,
yeah.
Between the time of you speaking with them and getting a check in the mail, that could be 2 to 3 weeks easy. And so then, you know, there's a month almost of your first, you know, so you got to move pretty quickly. And I've seen it, unfortunately, where, you know, checks get lost in the mail or delayed. And so that's why the 60 days is important. But yeah, that's a good point to bring up with 1099s to kind of put a bow on all the 1099 concepts. Right.
Yeah, because the idea is you're going to have 1099, you're going to owe taxes if you made money.
Yeah.
But if you didn't make money, you didn't take a distribution, there should be no 1099. In either case, if that's a situation that has occurred with you and you'd like to have somebody take a look at it, you can give our office a call, 503-253-3000. Once again, we don't do tax preparation. We don't give tax advice. We rely on your CPA, right? We rely on your tax professional to make sure that we're doing it right. But the key that you said in there is don't panic, right? Because if you are doing the right thing, then the IRS is not going to penalize you as long as you're not taking the withdrawal, as long as you're not taking those disbursements when you're not supposed to, right?
And I'm sure it happens a lot more than we think. And IRS, I mean, as much as, you know, everybody, nobody really likes paying taxes, and so the IRS gets the back name. They have, you know, some leniency, and they understand that, you know, ultimately we're all human. We make mistakes and errors happen. So a lot of times, you know, things, not saying that they would, but potentially could, even if you made a mistake and you deposited 62 days later, perhaps they could, you know, at least you could talk with them and saying, hey, could we maybe not penalize me? So
right.
There's also that. So as long as you just have all your documentation, that's important, you know,
yes.
Like if, you know, where did the money go, make copies of all the documents. When you get that rollover check, it usually comes with a pay stub on top. Don't throw that away. If you can, make a copy, save it somewhere in your tax files just for future. Because if you were to call your old place you had your retirement, I mean, they can regenerate that probably, but you know, you don't have any assets with them anymore, and so they have very little skin in the game, and they don't necessarily need to provide the best service and get you that right away. So I would say that that's also another good point, to just keep all records of that stuff for as long as you keep your regular records. So
yeah, exactly, you want to make sure, and also, you know, you want to make sure that it's deposited correctly, because if the financial institution that receives it,
yeah, they've got to code it as, you know, a deposit that's a rollover, not a contribution, because that's a big difference. You know, if you're rolling over a 401k, let's say $100,000, you don't want to code that as a contribution, because you're not allowed to put that much money in an IRA.
Right.
So, you know, it would cause an issue later and the form would look wrong and then have to get fixed. So that's where it's important. So when you get a receipt for the deposit, that's also important to review it and ask questions. You know, that's okay. You know, when you're sitting with your advisor, if they're depositing it, or you mail it in and you get a receipt, that is your opportunity to review that receipt, make sure it looks correct. And if it doesn't, or you feel uneasy about it, ask them, ask your accountant, whoever you're doing your taxes, to review it just to be sure.
Just to make sure it's coded right. So if you've had, like I said, if you've had that issue, or if you're thinking about doing a rollover, you're contemplating, you know, combining your accounts, anything like that, make sure you work with a trusted professional. As Taylor said earlier, it doesn't have to be us. We'd like it to be us. We're happy to help. But if you'd like to explore how that might work with us, give us a call, 503-253-3000, or visit us on the web at pfgwm.com. Thank you so much for tuning in this week. We really appreciate you. If you have questions, you'd like something to be covered on a future show, please send that question to askbo, A-S-K-B-O, at pfgwm.com. We'd be happy to answer that. We're happy to cover it. As we said, we're working on getting other trusted professionals in to answer those questions. I'm hopeful Steve Anderson, the property tax guy, will be back on soon.
Yep, and I'm working on somebody to come talk about real estate in the commercial space, so we should have them hopefully next few weeks. And then one other ad is on our website. If anybody's interested, under our website, we have some new guides that were posted about, you know, tips on filing your taxes and things to avoid. So if you go to our website, as Bill said, pfgwm.com, that you should be able to get through the guides and download some interesting articles and posts. Try to keep that stuff updated, so some, you know, lots of people have given us some good feedback that it's good information.
So. Yeah, perfect. So I think that's a good place to end it. Thank you so much for listening. Thanks for tuning in. You guys have a great rest of your weekend, and don't miss next week on Investing Simplified.
The opinions voiced in Investing Simplified with Bo Caldwell are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine what may be appropriate for you, consult with your attorney, accountant, financial or tax advisor prior to investing. Investors cannot invest directly in indexes. The performance of any index is not indicative of the performance of any investment and does not take into account the effects of inflation and the fees and expenses associated with investing. Guests on Investing Simplified are not affiliated with CWM LLC. Investment advisory services offered through CWM LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor.
We do Investing Simplified.